Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today we have returning guest, the legendary Doug Casey. Doug is the founder of Casey Research, best-selling author, world-renowned speculator, and libertarian philosopher. He literally wrote the book on profiting from periods of economic turmoil. His book, Crisis Investing, spent multiple weeks as number one on New York Times bestseller list. He's lived in 10 countries, visited over 175, and lives these days mostly between Uruguay and Argentina. As a podcast, Doug Casey's Take, and is blogging on internationalman.com. Also, he's done several novels, Speculator, Drug Lord, Assassin, and One to Come, Terrorist. Welcome, Doug. How are you?
Well, good, Richard. It's nice to talk to you. I'm speaking to you from Phuket Island in Thailand at the moment.
Yeah, that's a fascinating part of the world. And maybe we could begin with your global perspective on the economy and the financial markets.
Well, I'm afraid that we're about to enter a new era. The whole world more or less revolves around the United States at this point, which is interesting in that Americans aren't aware of this, but only 4% of the world's population lives in the US, but that 4% has an immense influence on the way the world goes. And with the elections coming up in a month at this point, interestingly enough, on Guy Fawkes Day in November, not sure if many Americans are aware of Guy Fawkes Day, but in the 17th century, an Englishman by that name attempted to blow up Parliament and almost succeeded. And it's said that Guy Fawkes was the only man that ever entered Parliament with honest intentions ever since then. And a really great movie was made of a takeoff of that called V for Vendetta. Have you seen that?
No, but that sounds interesting.
Oh, I would definitely put it on your view list. Before Election Day or Guy Fawkes Day comes up in the U.S. In any event, getting back to what you said before, the world is changing rapidly. I mean, these people at the World Economic Forum, which comprehends most of the world's big deal politicians, big deal businessmen, big deal entertainers, big deal everybody's. They all go to the World Economic Forum in Davos and conspire with each other.
Yeah. About how,
I like to think about keeping the plebs in line. They've talked of a great reset, and I think it's ongoing as we speak. So what does that mean to us little people out there? Interesting in that the stock market is at all-time highs, and I'd say in bubble area, I want no part of it. The bond market is a triple threat to your capital. It's in bubble territory still, even though it's come down a lot. The real estate market in the US rests on a sea of debt, and I can make an argument that interest rates, which have been coming down for basically 40 years before, well, 2 years ago when they turned around, the real estate market in the US is in a lot of trouble. So I'm afraid that talking to me today is going to amount to a dose of gloom and doom porn.
No, I think it needs to be discussed. Yeah, especially now with the recent geopolitical events. What do you make of that and the effects on the economy and the financial markets from those events?
Well, this war in the Ukraine, the Russians are going to win. There's no question in my mind about that, nor has there ever been. And actually, I hate to say it because the Russians did invade Ukraine, but that was after being mightily provoked for years. That war is going to continue for a while, but the Russians are going to win. As long as NATO doesn't provoke them further by launching missiles or airstrikes deep into Russian territory. The big thing at the moment is this dust-up between the Israelis and the Palestinians, where the Iranians are being drawn into this. This could start off amongst World War III. Either of these things could. So this is very scary stuff, because in both conditions, both wars, the Ukraine war and the Israel-Palestine war, they could go nuclear, and they could get out of control, and they could spread. And we could actually, we have as good a chance of blowing up the world now as we've had since the Cuban Missile Crisis back in the 60s. So these are scary times. The markets are dangerous. The world geopolitical situation is dangerous. The demographic and political situation in the United States is very dangerous. So listen, I prefer living in mellow times than times such as these. Although right here in Thailand at the moment, everything seems hunky-dory. I mean, if I didn't watch the news and I just looked out my window, I'd say, hey, everything is fine.
Yeah, but it could be the calm before the storm, especially with the upcoming U.S. elections. Do you see potential civil unrest resulting from, no matter who wins, which sides?
Yeah, I'm afraid that's true, Richard. No matter who wins, because the red people and the blue people in the U.S. have become highly polarized. And for the last several years, I mean, we all know that if you have Thanksgiving dinner with people in your family that are on the other side of this philosophical divide, you better not talk about it, or it's going to get ugly and unpleasant. Yeah. So the answer to the question is, yeah, I don't care who wins, the Democrats or the Republicans. If the Democrats win, and I think they are going to win, I hate to say that, but I'm just calling them as I see them. The Trumpsters, the Republicans, the average American, frankly, living in a heartland state, is going to feel, wait a minute, we've got a hardcore communist, which is Kamala. I'm pronouncing it in the Spanish way, incidentally, which means how bad. And, you know, that vice presidential person, what's his name, Waltz, kind of a elderly soy boy, is a hardcore socialist. People are going to react against that because they're going to try to put a really highly left-wing agenda into force. And Washington has long been captured by, I'd say, Jacobins. I say Jacobins because these people in Washington have the same philosophy. They have the same psychological makeup as the Jacobins did in France after the French Revolution. Very dangerous, very ugly. And they don't want to lose power now that they're there. So this could blow up any number of ways. And of course, if Trump wins, we know what the left wing is going to do. We saw that with Antifa and with BLM, with those riots a couple of years ago. They actually hate Trump. I'm not a big Trump fan myself, for reasons we could discuss, but they actually hate America. They want to transform America. That's the good thing about Trump. It's that for all his numerous faults, at least he doesn't want to overthrow the basic idea of America. He's a cultural conservative. So that's why I hope he wins. He's got a lot of stupid ideas. Otherwise, economically, we can discuss why I say that. But we're headed towards big trouble in the next month. And it's going to continue for years because we're looking at tremendous economic depression in addition to everything else. These are tough times we're headed into, I think.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? You mentioned the economic policies. Each candidate seems to be a tendency of policies that would be inflationary. What are your thoughts? Like, you got, on the one hand, tariffs that could increase up to 100%. On the other hand, price controls that could lead to empty shelves and more inflation. What are your thoughts on?
Oh yeah, it's what these people want is a formula for disaster. It's actually stupid, and I'm not using the word stupid as a pejorative. Okay, I'm not using it as an insult. I'm using it in a technical way. These people, whether we're talking about the Trumpers or the Kamalistas, see the immediate and short-term, the immediate and direct consequences of their actions, price controls, tariffs. They look good in the immediate and direct ways, but they never see the indirect and delayed effects, which are much more serious. And one's almost as bad as the other. It's interesting, in both of these debates, they were talking to each other, and nobody ever mentioned monetary policy. Nobody mentioned the fact, or fiscal policy, nobody mentioned the fact that the government is running a $2 trillion per year deficit. And Nobody's buying all that debt except the Federal Reserve. And they print up money. That's what the Federal Reserve does. They buy U.S. government debt by printing up new Federal Reserve notes that they deposit in commercial banks to the benefit of the federal government, which then spends it. And then this filters through the commercial banking system with fractional reserves there. And they didn't touch any of that stuff. And the reason is the average American doesn't have a clue about anything that I just said. It's way over their heads. It's not something that's ever talked about in economics classes in college even, but it's the heart of the inflationary problem. It's the heart of the debt problem, which is huge and disastrous. I'm not just talking about the $36 trillion the U.S. government owes, which will never be repaid, but debt on all levels, well, right up to including the fact that the average American has the highest level of credit card debt in history now, and he's paying, what, 20, 22, 24% interest on it. What are you doing with $1.5 trillion worth of debt that you're paying 24% interest on? That's unsustainable, to use a popular word.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Yeah, and the credit card you mentioned, just even on the government side, sort of looks like the government, U.S. government, having difficulty making payments, like minimum payments on a credit card, if you will, with the interest on the national debt as well, right? That's a big challenge.
Yeah, and I don't see how they can dig themselves out of this problem at this point. I mean, it's been ever since the Vietnam War, it's been pretty apparent that the government was digging itself into a hole that, well, but they could have dug themselves, but they passed the point of no return. And why do I say that in particular? It's that out of federal spending every year, about 93% of the money the federal government spends is for, I'll itemize it. It's for Social Security, that's a rice bowl that you can't break. It's for Medicaid and Medicare, can't break those. That's written in stone. It's for the so-called defense establishment. That's the wrong word, because it's no longer about defense. It's about the weapons industry, gets all the money. It's for interest on the federal debt, which is about $1 trillion a year alone and is going up. Because I think interest rates are going up regardless of what how the Fed jimmies rates. So 93% of what the federal government spends is kind of written in stone. Only 7% goes to running the government and everything else. Now there's no way out of this at this point.
Yeah, looks like
I'd love it if somebody would like Ron Paul, who ran for a couple of years ago, well, more than that, the presidency, would come in with a chainsaw like Milei in Argentina is that he's doing and just hack away all these government programs and spending. But it ain't going to happen because the population would just scream too hard. Almost everybody's on some kind of welfare, whether it's an individual or whether it's a corporation that's getting in what is in effect welfare. So nobody wants their rice bowl broken. It's going to wind up with first foreign exchange controls and then price controls we were talking about and more tariffs and then finally foreign exchange controls and the total destruction of the US dollar, which is on its way because a lot of countries, all the BRICS countries in the world don't want to use the US dollar anymore. And they, for very good reasons, incidentally, and they're going to stop using it. And that's our main asset. It's our ability to send out worthless paper. And the nice foreigners send us Mercedes and Sonys and cocaine in exchange for the paper we print up. So that's going to come to an end too. Big changes coming, big changes.
Yeah. Yeah, do you see more monetization by the Federal Reserve, given that Asia is selling U.S. Treasury bonds like China, even Japan, where they're encouraging private companies to sell U.S. Treasury bonds to repatriate that? Is it going into infrastructure development back in Asia or central bank gold buying? What are your thoughts on those issues?
Well, infrastructure in Asia. You know, since I've been in Malaysia and Thailand for the last 3 weeks, one thing I notice here, not having been here since before the COVID hysteria hit, is that everything here in the Orient works and it's new and it's nice. There's no potholes in the roads. The buildings are new. Everything is spick and span and clean and modern. I mean, and it's changed radically in the last 50 years. When I first came to the Orient 50 years ago, it's transformed. You go back in the United States or Canada, or for that matter in Europe, nothing's changed. Same crappy old buildings that are deteriorating, crappy old roads that are deteriorating. Things are dirty, things that don't work, there's strikes and so forth. So I'm afraid that the Orient's on its way up and unfortunately, the West is on its way out and down. And well, it makes sense because the West has so much debt, it's living on borrowed money. And you just can't do that, not over the long term. You can do it, sure, over the short term, but and these places here, the average guy saves a substantial part of his salary and puts it away and invests it. I mean, it's actually scary how far we're going downhill, relatively speaking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we both take a view on the Austrian school of economics, emphasizing savings and investment versus borrowing and spending in the Keynesian economics way. That's probably a big theme, right, between what's happening in the indebted Western world and the global South, you know, including Asia. What are your thoughts on what's happening in Argentina? Is that, you know, given Javier Milei, also an Austrian school economist, what are your thoughts? And how did that happen? Did they go so low that they had no other choice to do, or did maybe give it a try?
Yeah. Well, as you know, I live most of the year in Argentina and Uruguay. And in Argentina, of course, something's happened with the election of Javier Milei that's actually of world historic importance. It's the first time in world history, I think, that somebody campaigned on the basis of, I'm going to take a chainsaw to the Argentine government and basically dismantle it. I'm basically going to pull out this weed and I'm going to pour Agent Orange where it grew. So it was wonderful. And I think that's why the average Argentine voted for them. They weren't voting for somebody that claimed that we're going to give you more free stuff. They've been there. Their currencies have been destroyed totally numerous times. And that's a disaster because it makes it impossible for the average guy to save money to get ahead when there's high inflation. I mean, you're like running on a treadmill. You can't get ahead. In fact, you keep getting behind. So inflation is a gigantic disaster. And that's what the Argentines were voting against. And they've been living with corruption and regulation. They were voting to get rid of that too. So I'm all for Javier Milei, and he's done some tremendous things so far, firing government employees and eliminating agencies, but he hasn't been as radical as I would have liked. He hasn't yet abolished their central bank. Argentines, smart Argentines, for many decades, get their money out of the country, which is one reason why the country's been going downhill, downhill, downhill. Nobody's got any confidence in the place. So they ship all their money to Switzerland and the US and other places. So there's hundreds of billions of dollars that Argentines own that are waiting to come back to Argentina when it looks like the going's safe, the sharks are out of the water. Argentina could boom. It doesn't need a peso. He should have. He's an Austrian. Yes, he's an anarcho-capitalist. But he hasn't abolished the bank yet, and I don't understand why. And he's making other mistakes, like Argentina doesn't have an army, but he's bought fighter planes from the U.S. What the hell does Argentina need fighter planes for? That's a waste of money. I don't understand what's going on. And he wants to join NATO. Wait a minute. That's the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. That's crazy. Yeah. And he supports that little swindler Zelensky in the Ukraine, who, you know, was supposed to have an election 6 months ago and didn't, and is still the president. I mean, talk about our democracy, which we're supporting by paying their government's bills, as well as that stupid war against Russia. I don't know. And Milei supports all this stuff. So, and he's not destroying their government and all their stupid regulatory agencies that are bankrupting the country and the average guy fast enough. I don't know. I support him, yeah, because he's much, much better than the alternative. But I don't know. I hope he hasn't been corrupted.
Yeah, I think that was one of his big target mandates, to abolish the central bank, I think, from the beginning. We actually did a couple of podcasts with him on this program show before he got elected.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
How was his English? Did he get by okay?
No, it was actually in Spanish, so I don't speak Spanish myself, but just did the intro and I had some other guests that were conducting, facilitating the podcast. But yeah, it was quite interesting. But hardly anybody knew him at that time. But Yeah, I think, I mean, he has done a few things positive, like on the rental controls. The rental prices are now going lower, and there used to be no rental units on the market. Now there are.
That's a
So some of those.
favorable thing he's done, no doubt. That's right. And of course, those were wonderful speeches that he gave to the United Nations and to the people in Davos. Although I wonder if they listened to him at all. I mean, these people are so basically antithetical to freedom ideas and so corrupt that he was just talking into the wind, although there were good speeches.
Yeah. And then in that region of the world, like South America, what are your thoughts for investment ideas? Not just in Argentina, but in the region?
Yeah, well, all the countries in South America and Latin America too, counting Central America, they're all very different from each other. And I believe, notwithstanding the fact that Milei is not living up to his promise, I think the best place to put money is actually in Argentina. Well, I'll contradict myself. Venezuela, this is one that has come out of left field. Let's talk about that in a moment. But Argentina, I've been very heavily committed to Argentine and Uruguayan real estate for a long time, prematurely, obviously. I think since it's so depressed, I'll give you an example. When I bought my apartment in Buenos Aires in the Recoleta, which is like the Upper East Side of New York equivalent, I paid just under $1 million for it back in, what was it, 2007, I think. And at that time, that apartment, if I transported it to the Upper East Side, would have been $20 million. So Argentine real estate of that type was selling for a 95% discount. I figured, okay, it's the bottom. I can't go wrong. Here we are now, 15 plus years later, and that apartment's worth $1.5 million, and the dollar's worth only half as much. So I've lost money in real terms. And it's still worth only 5 or 6 or 7% what it would be if it was in the Upper East Side of New York. Answer to the question, if you want to buy a great apartment in a great place in a country that I think is going to be doing well for, I hope, the next 10 years. Yeah, come to Argentina, no question. Great lifestyle, cheap standard of living, and you can make a score on real estate. And let me make a prediction, not that we'll do this show again 20 years from now, but I think that in 20 years, that apartment in Buenos Aires is going to be worth more. Not just 5% of, but worth equal or more than its equivalent in Manhattan. That's a radical prediction. I think it's possible. But there's another place in Latin America that's really just come on my radar screen, and that's Venezuela. Everybody knows it's a total and complete disaster. But just the other day, I was talking with a couple of Venezuelans. Young people, lawyers, visit Caracas all the time. And they told me that the bottom came in the Venezuelan real estate market about 6 months ago. And prices of houses, which had fallen 90% from the peak, have tripled in the last 6 months. So I think the bottom has come in Venezuela. And you might ask, well, why? Because it still seems like Venezuela is a disaster, and it is. But two things have changed and gotten better in Venezuela. Number one, all their criminals, of which there were many, have all gone north. We've got them in the United States. Listen, it's true. Caracas, they say, is now one of the safest cities in the world, because all the criminals have left town. There's fatter, easier pickings in the US. Yeah. And no danger of getting caught, and you come to the U.S. and not only that, you got free medical and, you know, walk free money from the government. I mean, it's insane what's going on with the migrant situation, but it's helped Caracas. So that's number one, why the real estate market in Caracas has turned around. And the second thing is that Maduro still needs money because it's a socialist regime and they're always bankrupt. So he's taken Margarita Island, which is this beautiful island off the coast of Venezuela, Caribbean island, and he's turned it into a special economic zone.
Wow.
So capital can come in there and there's prosperity. So that's why. Those two things. Yeah. Maybe some others, but anyway.
Some oil and gas.
Latin America.
Yeah.
Argentina. In Venezuela, speculation. Those I don't know where else. I mean, we can talk about all the other countries, but I think those are the two interesting ones.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. We're actually in ourselves on some, like there's a real estate investment trust or two in Argentina that's very interesting, and maybe oil and gas, U.S. oil and gas that have some type of interest or connection with Venezuela. Those are interesting. And we're looking at the
and of course Argentina has a huge gas field in Patagonia near the Andes Mountains, and now that they've got a responsible government there, capital will flow in, and Argentina could become a real boom country for gas and oil.
Interesting. And what about on the precious metals market, turning to that, gold, silver, but also palladium and platinum seem to be interesting. Your thoughts there?
Well, I've always been a gold bug because I believe gold is money. And one of the nice things about Bitcoin arising is that it's introduced a whole generation to the fact that the U.S. dollar is just a fiat currency. Paper money, and that's helped to draw some attention to gold. So what, gold is like $2,600, $2,650 as we speak, something on that order. It's volatile up here. But I think that there's no alternative to the government continuing to print more money. Nobody's gonna lend them money. They can't get enough in taxes. And so they're using what's known as modern monetary theory, which basically says the government can just print money to get what it wants. And if it thinks there's too much money printing, it just taxes it from people they don't like. And that's how they're, I mean, this is actually criminally insane, but that's what they're doing. That's what they're up to. So gold is going higher because they're gonna keep printing money. And silver has been sticking its head up a lot, and at some point silver is going to get the bit in its teeth and go back to its previous highs, which is $50 an ounce. But $50 back then is worth $200 today, so I think we could see $200 silver sometime in the next couple of years. And I don't know about palladium and platinum because they're pure industrial metals. Silver is kind of semi-monetary. And since I'm a bear on the economy, I'm not sure if I like them. But on the other hand, all of the platinum and palladium come out basically come out of Russia and South Africa. And South Africa is actually going into collapse. And you can't tell what's going to happen with World War III with Russia, which is... So no firm opinion on those two metals.
Interesting. And do you see a potential repeat or rhyming of the 1966 to 1982 period of time, given we talked earlier about very high potential for inflation for a long time, and given all the monetary printing, could we get asset prices staying sort of relatively nominally at the same level, but precious metals going much higher and inflation going much higher, so that the real terms value of equities in general and maybe housing in general, especially in the indebted Western world, they go lower? You see that potential?
Well, talk about the Western world. I certainly wouldn't want to own anything in Europe, because Europe is on the front lines of World War III, no matter from where it materializes, number one. And number two, all those European governments are much worse, actually, than the U.S. government. Plus, they've got the European Union on top of them all from Brussels. So if I was a European that had a little bit of money, I'd get the hell out of Europe. And where would I go? You might want to come here to the Southeast Asia, which has a lot of favorable things to draw you. Or I would look at going to Argentina or Uruguay. I think there's going to be tens of thousands of well-to-do Europeans that are going to pile into Argentina and Uruguay and southern Brazil also in the years to come. I think those three places could boom, and the Orient's going to boom anyway. So yeah, that's as far as Europe's concerned. As far as the U.S. market's concerned, I don't have any desire to be in it, and certainly not the bond market. I think interest rates hit bottom after a 40-year period of going down. And now, with all this money printing going on, I think we're looking for a long period when interest rates, I don't care what the Federal Reserve does or says, interest rates are going up. So you don't want to own bonds, for sure. And if you don't want to own bonds, that means that it's going to be tougher and tougher to borrow money to buy real estate, houses, buildings, what have you. And they're going to go down in value. Plus, these local governments are all going bankrupt, especially with all the migration going on. They've got to, for some reason, are paying for all these welfare recipients. So real estate taxes could only go higher. I don't want to own any real estate in the U.S., really. There's better places to own real estate. And the next thing that's going to happen, I think, in the U.S., almost regardless of whether it's Trump or Kamala are installed, I think we're looking at foreign exchange controls. So if you're not diversified internationally, it may become too late or really expensive to get your money out of the country.
Yeah, I agree. And just a final question on your novels, your novels of fiction. Can you mention about that, discuss, are they intended to give a message, or what are your thoughts on the current, the three books you've done and the one book that's coming?
Well, I've written a number of nonfiction books, and two of them have hit the New York Times bestseller list and stayed there for quite a while. But I prefer doing fiction because you can put across ideas in fiction, I think, much more effectively. And the first one that I wrote with my partner, John Hunt, was called Speculator. What we're doing is we're tracing a young American's pilgrim's progress through life. And first he becomes a speculator, gets lucky in a gold mining stock in Africa, because that's what I mainly do, is speculate in mining stocks, which are very cheap, incidentally, right now, something that another subject. Gets involved in a bush war in Africa, and it's all about being a speculator in Africa. And then makes a lot of money, government steals a lot of it. He becomes a drug lord. That's what the second book is about, both legal drugs and illegal drugs. And then the government steals his money again, and he gets pissed off this time, and he becomes an assassin. We're reforming politically unpopular occupations. Yeah. Nobody likes speculators or drug lords or assassins. But we show that Charles is a really good guy doing the right thing. So now, after an assassin, I think everybody will really like that book. It's pretty exciting. They all are. Now we're working on a fourth one where it's called Terrorist, where Charles is now accused of being a terrorist. And I have a lot of views and theories about terrorism as a method of warfare. So the fourth book, which will be coming out, is called Terrorist. But don't wait for that. Don't fall behind and read the first three. So go on Amazon and get them. You'll be happy you did.
Yeah, very interesting. And how can our listeners learn and viewers learn more about your work? Like, is it on the blog or internationalman.com?
Yeah, internationalman.com. It's a free blog, And I write an article every week, which is pretty good. And we've got every week, David Stockman, who was Reagan's budget director, writes an article, and several other guys that are really good. So it's a great blog. Everybody should subscribe to internationalman.com. And I do a podcast with Matt Smith a couple times a week, where we talk about everything going on in the world. That's on YouTube. And so we get kicked off YouTube, and then we'll do it on Rumble. So we got those two things. And we have also a paid newsletter called Crisis Investing. But subscribe to the other two things and see if you groove on the type of thing we're talking about before you sign up for that one.
Well, great. It's been a fascinating, insightful discussion. Words of wisdom from Doug Casey. Thank you so much, Doug.
Thanks. Thanks, Richard. It's a pleasure being here with you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.